But we're going to slow down a little bit as we go into chapter 12 of Exodus. Chapter 11, we did go through, and it's a shorter one. It's where Moses announces to Pharaoh what's going to happen. Remember, they're there, they're having this altercation. Moses agrees to bring an end to the ninth plague, the darkness. But when Pharaoh gets so angry, and you know he's been trying to negotiate, and I find that interesting. It's like, who's going? Well, just have the males go. And then, well, don't go very far. Sacrifice here in the land. And well, you can go with your wives and your kids, but leave your animals behind. You know, he's trying to get something back. And each time, you know, God has Moses be very firm. No, we're not bargaining. We're not negotiating. It's going to be what it's going to be. And of course, God has all the power in the universe. He doesn't have to negotiate or compromise. And at the end, there's anger. And Pharaoh says, if I see you again, I'm going to kill you. Moses says, that's fine. You're never going to see me again. But before he leaves, he announces the plague of the death of the firstborn that's going to come. Okay, now we go into chapter 12. And it says, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, many scholars think it would have been better to be translated, the Lord had spoken to Moses. And we're not certain, and so I lean that way, but it's not something that absolutely matters, but it makes sense for a lot of this instruction to have been given before Moses made that announcement to Pharaoh. It could have been otherwise. And we can think about when God said this to Moses. We know it could not have happened any later than the 10th of the month of the first month, the month of Abib or Nisan, because he gives them instructions for something they have to do on the 10th day. So he spoke to him before then. I think it's likely that he spoke before the first of that month. And as I said, perhaps before the exchange that we just read in verse 11. Having said that, we see in verse 2, this month shall be your beginning of months. It'll be the first month of the year to you. I've often read this and made the comment, notice God doesn't say, Moses, let me tell you what a month is. It's assumed that they have a calendar that's operating, so God is not saying, now I'm going to establish a calendar, but he does seem to be saying, I want you to rearrange or rename which is the first month. And we see that today. We call it the sacred calendar, you know, and it's marked. Those little pocket calendars we get from the church will show us when the month starts and when Passover is. And all this time, though, the Jews have maintained what is the seventh month by that reckoning to be the first month for civil purposes. And to me, that always seems confusing, but that's the way they do it. And of course, the seventh month is the month that has all the fall holy days in it. And the first day of that month is what we call trumpets, beginning at what's called the Molad of Tishri. And I'm not going to get into all that right now, but they maintain that that was the original first month from creation. And that here, when God speaks to Moses, he's basically changing and say, now call this month number one, instead of, you know, what is now seven being one. Does that make sense? I feel like I'm stumbling over my words in this. Yeah, Matt?
But what I'd heard is that actually the Jews knew is the first month was Abib, but it's actually when they went into Babylon, they start incorporating the seventh month as the first month of the year.
Okay. So
it's like pagan tradition, not...
And that could well be. So there's different versions of this. One of the things I wanted to mention, as I said, it seems they had an effective calendar. And archaeology has shown that in ancient Mesopotamia, they found evidence of people using a lunar calendar that had intercalary months. That is, months that you insert some years and not others, that worked through a 19-year cycle. And that's exactly the way the calendar, the Hebrew calendar that the Jews use, works. Leaning or supporting the idea, perhaps, this is the calendar that existed from at least the flood, if not going all the way back to Adam and Eve, and it's just not recorded in the Bible. Now, there are some people that would argue otherwise. We're so established here in America with the Roman Gregorian calendar, you know, we think of anything that varies from that as being unusual, but it hasn't always been around, and it's shown in history when it started. Anyways, having said that, let's move on, you know, because their focus isn't on the months of the calendar. As I said, it seems to be taken for granted. And instead, he talks about what to do when. Then verse 3, speak to the congregation on the 10th of this month. Every man take for himself a lamb according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household. The Hebrew word that's translated lamb is one that's appropriate for either a sheep or a goat, a young of either of them. So that Hebrew word can mean either. And down in verse 5, God, it shows that it doesn't matter because he says you can take it from the sheep or the goats. Which is just a little interesting thing because when we think of Passover, we always think of a lamb. But it could have, a goat was acceptable in this case. But you set it aside on the 10th day, and you're going to sacrifice it later on the 14th. So the question comes up, why? Matter of fact, let me go forward. If the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to him take it according to the number of persons. According to each man's need, you'll make account for the lamb. Your lamb will be without blemish, a male of the first year from the sheep or the goats. Keep it until the 14th day of the whole month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation shall kill it at twilight. So there's a number of things there, and I'll back up and cover some of them. One question that comes up is, why segregate it for 4 days? Why set it aside on the 10th day so that you can sacrifice it on the 14th? And I'm asking the question because it doesn't tell us. So there's been a number of thoughts. Only two of them ring very true to me. Anybody familiar with those? Yes, Emily?
Maybe it was because if they had it, it seems like it's in their household with them. They're taking such close care of it. They'd build this sort of a connection with it. So it's not like they're just sacrificing, oh, you know, this just mm-hmm. this lamb. Like there's an actual meaning to that lamb.
So you get attached to it.
Yeah,
over
like
the course.
An attachment.
Maybe it in the house or it's right next there and the kids go out and feed it and you might be foolish enough to give it a name. And then when you have to slash its throat, it hurts. I think there's something to that. I think that might be one of the reasons. Because remember, this sacrifice is symbolic of Jesus Christ's sacrifice, which had real meaning. So I wouldn't say, oh, maybe this is wrong. The fact is the scripture doesn't say why. So I think that's a valid reason. The reason why most of the observing Jews say that they set it aside, in absence of any other reason, they say is to have 4 days to take a good look at it and make sure it really is without blemish. And I could see doing that, but part of me says, come on, you could do that in a few minutes if you take a close look. But, you know, I can't disprove that. Okay, now there's concern if the household is too small. How many people is right for this Passover sacrifice? Again, the scripture doesn't define it. Later on, the rabbis would, and they would say that the number needed to be somewhere between 10 and 20. So that's the number that arose by tradition. It's not something that matters to us because we don't keep Passover in the same way. But we come down to, of course, verse 6, keep it until the 14th day and kill it at twilight. It's important for us to know that word has nothing to do with a movie about vampires. And it's actually a phrase. It's, I'm not, see if I'm spelling it properly, bien ha arbayim, A-R-B-A-Y-M. I want to make sure I get this right because actually in earlier class I got them backwards. There's another word for dusk, areb, that is a more generalized term. But this is the Hebrew and it literally means between the evenings. Now you might not have heard of bien ha areb, but you've probably, being in the church, heard of between the evenings. Okay, and that's what this is. It's generally accepted to be that time of we call dusk. It's getting dark, but it's not completely dark. More specifically defined, we look at it from the time of sunset until it is dark. So the idea is, okay, you wait till the sun is down and you do the sacrifice before it gets dark. So you've got a window of time, but not a real large window. Now that developed over the years, and we could question the appropriateness, but if you move to New Testament times, when the instruction will be later, instead of doing this at their home, which is what they're doing here, later it said, come to the place where God puts his name, which would be at Jerusalem, and you're going to have thousands of people having to sacrifice these lambs. Now, there's open questions. Some have said, well, you have to come to the temple. Well, although some have said, no, you don't have to come to the temple, you just have to be in the vicinity of Jerusalem. But if they do all come to the temple, how many can you slay in that brief window between sundown and dusk? And the reason I'm telling you this is that the rabbis made the decision that between the evenings went from noon until dark. So they backed it up. I don't think that's quite correct. And of course, our keeping of the Passover, we don't kill a lamb, but we do want to keep it in the New Testament manner at the correct time. So that's why when you go, you know, we're very cognizant of when is sundown where we are, and we don't do the ceremony before sundown. But considering it's late, we usually don't wait till long after sundown. And of course, that's when you start it. It'll go on for a little while, as their keeping of the Passover would. Keep in mind, of course, the Passover lamb clearly symbolized Jesus Christ and his sacrifice. I think it almost goes without saying, but it shouldn't go without saying. You know, Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us, as something said in the New Testament a number of times. I'll give you some references. Hebrews 9, verses 13 and 14 is one. And depending on what edition of the Bible you have, it might already be written in your margin. But that was Hebrews 9, 13 and 14. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 2. 1 Peter 1, 2. And 1 Corinthians 5, 7. 1 Corinthians 5, 7. And I want to stress that the spiritual meaning behind Passover is the most important. But since we're studying the Pentateuch right now, and the people there didn't fully understand that, we're not going to spend as much time on it. I'm going to look at the physical stuff that they did. Okay, so, but that's not to imply that I don't understand what Passover is really about. So let's move on to verse 7. So they do this. After they kill it, you know, at Bien Ha... Arbaim, take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the house where they'll eat it. So the blood was put in a clearly visible place at the entrance of the family's house. Now, although it doesn't say it here, it's been commonly thought that perhaps this is symbolic. Many people have said the two doorposts represent the two hands and the lintel above represents the head, meaning representing what we do and what we think. I think that's kind of cool. And it might well be what God had in mind, just that he didn't state it explicitly if he did. 1 Peter 1, 2. Yeah. And then 1 Corinthians 5, 7. And there might be others. These are the ones that when I was putting together my notes. So they put the blood there. And then let's read the next few verses. Verse 8, they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs they'll eat it. Don't eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted with fire. So specific instructions. Its head with its legs and its entrails. Which, it doesn't mean you have to eat the head and the entrails, but the idea is you don't butcher the animal. Like nowadays when you kill an animal and then you cut it up and you get rid of stuff that you don't like and you get cuts that you then cook. This is going to, you slash its throat, drain the blood, spit it, and turn it over the fire, the whole animal. And they'll be eating off of it. So what happens when you cook an animal that way? The outside meat cooks while the inside isn't. So the family would be gathered around and you cut parts of the outside off as it's done and you pass it out. And that lets the inner more meat continue to cook. So this is a long drawn out process is what I'm getting at. It's not like throwing a burger on the grill and you flip it a couple times and it's ready. This is, you know, you're turning it over the fire, you're gathered together. And we'll see that there's discussion about what they should talk about and how they should do this. Make a reference later in verse 22 of this chapter. It says, no one's allowed to leave the house before morning. Okay, that's very important. And that's important to our timing because we're going to want to look at several scriptures here that tell us when this started, when it ended, and when they left. Because there is debate among people who share most of our beliefs as to when these things happen. But to continue in verse 10, let none of it remain till morning. What remains of it until morning, burn with fire. Okay, there was to be nothing left that could spoil or be eaten by animals. Okay, so this is devoted, it's holy, and as we know, was symbolic of Jesus Christ. And as such, symbolizing Jesus Christ, you don't let, you know, the scavenger animals come and eat it later, dig it out of the trash. You don't even leave it for bacteria to consume. You burn it all up so that it can't be, the symbolism can't be misused. We do something similar today. You know, in our Passover service, if you've seen the ministers up there, you bless the wine, you bless the bread, and then you pass it around. And there's always some left because you want to make sure there's enough for everybody. What happens to what's left? we follow this example and we take it somewhere and burn it because it's now symbolic of Jesus Christ's body and we don't want it to be consumed by animals or anything else. I don't know if any of you were aware of that. Something I wasn't aware of it until I was ordained, and then you start getting involved. I had a funny, well, I don't know if it's a funny story, but still, it strikes me as amusing because the first Passover that I was a pastor, I went down to the Prestonsburg congregation, which is a small group. At that time, we had like 16 meeting in a hotel meeting room. And so we did the service, and I'm there with one fellow who would later be ordained a deacon. Say, we got to get rid of this. Well, did you bring any matches? We're scrambling around looking for matches. And we go outside in the parking lot, and there's these semi-trucks parked, and we're crumpling up paper trying to get a fire started to burn this stuff. And I always wonder, what do people think? Here's two men in two-piece suits and ties trying to start a fire in a hotel parking lot. We finally got it done. And one of the points is, whether or not it's inconvenient or even embarrassing, it needs to be done. We want to treat this stuff as something that's been blessed by God and has very important symbolism. Now, it's still symbolism. This is getting to another subject, and later you'll have comparative religion. We don't believe that the bread actually becomes Christ's body, which Catholic teaching says that it does. That's the doctrine of transubstantiation. But it's the symbolism that makes us treat it with such care. Let's move on here. In verse 11, you shall eat it with a belt on your waist, sandals on your feet, and a staff in your hand. And you'll eat it in haste. It's the Lord's Passover. Okay, it is a solemn occasion, and they're in preparation of a journey. They're about to start a journey that's going to last 40 years, although they don't know it's going to be that long, but so they're ready to go. We would say symbolically, we Christians today are on a spiritual journey, journeying to God's kingdom. So although, I wouldn't say there's a requirement when you come to a New Testament Passover service, we still wear shoes and belts as appropriate. You know, you don't come in your pajamas or anything like that, but let me move on. Well, actually, as far as the idea of a spiritual journey, I made a reference to Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2, where it says, let us cast aside the sin that besets us and run the race before us. I think it says, run with joy the race that's set before us. But going back to them, they're in their homes, they're gathered together, they're dressed, they got the staff, the shoes on. And verse 12, it says, I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I'll execute judgment. I am the Eternal. Now the blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. When I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Note it's stated in first person here. And so sometimes there's a discussion, did the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ come and do this himself, or did he work through an angel? You could make an argument either way, because if God delegates an angel to do a job for him, it is, God's doing that job in a sense through an agent. But it could have also been the Word coming and doing it. I'm not sure that it's worthy of argument, but no. And where it says gods of Egypt, that word, it's Elohe, if I have it transliterated correctly. And it's a word that can also be translated princes. So some people say, is he executing judgment on the princes of Egypt, or, of course, their false gods? Remember, the Egyptians worshipped animal-shaped gods, and the firstborn of animals were going to die in this plague as well as of people. So could be interpreted either way, or perhaps it meant both. It does say the blood would be a sign, symbolizing, of course, the blood of Jesus Christ. The blood over the door, around the entry to the Israelites' house saved them from death, as the blood of Christ saves us from eternal death. And 1 Peter 1, verse 19 is a good reference for that. 1 Peter 1, 19. And I'm pretty sure I'm telling you stuff that you kind of already know, but we want to tie it specifically here to Scripture. And one of the things you'd like to come out of ABC doing is saying, yeah, I knew this stuff, I've heard it all my life, and now I know I can find it in the Bible. Not that I have it all memorized, but yeah, I can take you there and show you why we do certain things and what it means. So we move on in verse 14. So this day shall be to you a memorial. You shall keep it as a feast of the Lord throughout your generations. Keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. That everlasting ordinance could be transliterated as Chukath Olam. C-H-U-K. I've got two K's for some reason. And it could also be translated endless statute. So everlasting ordinance, or endless statute. It's something that's meant to stick around. And the symbolism, of course, there's a reason why it would be there. Let's keep reading. In verse 15, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove the leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh, that person will be cut off from Israel. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation, and on the seventh day a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared of you. Okay, so one thing I want to note here is the Passover and the days of unleavened bread are here clearly established before the ritual ceremonial law. And I'm making that point because some people will say, yeah, well, we don't sacrifice animals anymore. They were part of that ritual law, and so were the holy days. But here we see they're not established at the same time, and we believe the holy days existed before and continued after the ritual sacrifice, largely because of what they mean and because they're holy time. We can see, I'll make a distinction here, two festivals established.
It's safe to say that Abraham kept these days, and the reason why God is giving instruction is because they're coming out of Egypt and they don't know of these things.
Possibly. And I say, it's safe to say. I think it's not incorrect to say, but we don't have exact evidence, except we do have Genesis 26:5 that says Abraham kept my statutes, laws, judgments. So that gives us the idea that perhaps Abraham was keeping them, but we don't have a written record of it. So, yeah, I don't think you could disprove that he's keeping them. So I think we're in agreement there. I just like to cover my bases like a lawyer. I mentioned two festivals and two holy days. And I'm using the term festival advisedly because a festival is not necessarily the same as a holy day. Because one festival I would define as Passover. The day of Passover is not a holy convocation. Okay, it's not a day that you're said not to work, not to assemble together and give an offering, but it's a special day. Okay, and then the days of unleavened bread, the days plural, are a seven-day festival. So you got Passover as a festival, days of unleavened bread are a festival. Okay, now you have two holy days or holy convocations, the first day of unleavened bread and the seventh day of unleavened bread. Those are specified to be holy convocations. So is that, I'm not sure if I'd say it's confusing. It's not that complicated, but we tend to jumble them together. We use festival and holy day or convocation as synonymous, but then it can be a little confusing, or it can get us caught up saying, okay, when I say name the holy days, usually you name Passover. It's like, well, not exactly. And we could speculate on the distinction. And, because the Bible doesn't tell us. It's interesting, at the other end of the holy day calendar, there's a seven-day festival, which is Tabernacles. One of those days is a holy day. And then there's another separate festival and holy day that's the eighth day. So it's like there's symmetry, only at the beginning of the holy day schedule, it starts with a day, in addition to a seven-day festival, but it's not holy. And at the other end, there's the additional day that is holy. And why? We could speculate and guess. One of the things I've thought of, although I couldn't prove and I wouldn't try to, is maybe it's because, at least for us, the meaning of Passover has been fulfilled completely. Christ is sacrificed, and he only had to be sacrificed one time. The major hole in that argument is at the time he's doing it here, or giving them that command, he hadn't been sacrificed. Although you could say the plan was there. We've got scriptures that say the lamb sacrificed from the foundation of the world. But again, I don't want to go there. Don't worry about memorizing that. That's just Frank Dunkel's thinking out loud. During the days of unleavened bread, of course, it says you don't eat leavened bread. Unleavened bread, 1 Corinthians 5 tells us, pictures sincerity and truth. Remember 1 Corinthians 5 verses 6 and 8. So to them, it just was something, God tells us to do this. Why? Well, I'm not sure that he gave them much explanation. I'll mention one other meaning for the bread during the days of unleavened bread, because Jesus Christ called himself the bread of life. The bread of life, that's in John 6, verse 35. So when we eat unleavened bread, we think of partaking of Christ's life and his existence. And in that same passage in 1 Corinthians 5, unleavened pictures malice and wickedness. So it's during those 7 days leavening pictures sin or malice and wickedness. Doesn't picture that any other time, which is good because I like leavened bread. But it has that symbolism at this time. Okay, verse 18. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. For 7 days, no leaven will be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that person will be cut off from the congregation, whether stranger or narrative, or stranger or native narrative. You shall eat nothing leavened in all your dwelling. You'll eat unleavened bread. Want to mark something. Sundown marks what? Now, the end of the day, but also the beginning of a day. It marks both. And what we want to note here in verse 18, it must be talking about the sundown that ends the 14th day, because that's when unleavened bread starts. This is something that's caused confusion. But it's obviously that, because if it were the sundown at the start of the 14th, that would mean the days of unleavened bread start on the 14th of Abib, not the 15th. Well, the Bible clearly says it starts on the 15th. And also, if it started on the 14th and ended the 21st, then there would be 8 days of unleavened bread, whereas the Bible clearly says it's 7 days. So that shows us, you know, again, there's a sundown that starts the 14th, there's a sundown that ends it. We'll see a similar thing actually later in Leviticus when he's describing the start of atonement. Atonement is the 10th day of the 7th month. But at one place it says at sundown on the 9th day, and it's referring to the start. And to me that makes sense, because you want to know exactly when you have to fast and exactly when you can stop fasting. So God, in some places God is very precise in that. Anyways, we were reading in verses 19 and 20, during those days, you know, leaven pictures sin. Okay, you have to put the stuff out of your, in verse 20 it says your dwellings. I've got in my notes habitations, I think from the old King James. What do we consider to include our dwellings or our habitations? Where do we put leaven out of? Okay, and as you said, our vehicles? Yeah. Okay, your property, certainly our houses. What I'm getting at there, they didn't have a lot of distinction. People lived and worked in about the same place. For us, for me, it includes my office. As a matter of fact, we de-leaven the whole building here. You know, and I remember when I worked in another office, I'd have to de-leaven. I have a habit of eating at my desk while I'm working. So, and I'd pack sandwiches, and so there'd be all these crumbs down on my keyboard. And I could have said, oh, it's not my dwelling, I don't live here, but to me, it's a place that's under my control, I should get the leaven out. Luckily, that was a keyboard I could pop the keys off. So I would pop the keys off, I'd line them up on my desk so I'd get them back in, get the vacuum and sweep out, and then put them back in. Every year, I'm sure my coworkers probably would look in and say, what in the world is he doing? Okay, so again, just making sure we see what we do is based on what's here. Verse 21, Moses called for the elders of Israel. So God had given the instruction to Moses. Now Moses is going to share it with the leaders of Israel, who will share it with all the people. Moses called for the elders, said, pick out and take lambs for yourself according to your families, and kill the Passover. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop. That's a type of plant, you know, that would work kind of like a mop or whatever. Dip it in the blood in the basin. Strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that's in the basin. And none of you go out of your house until morning. I mentioned that earlier. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door, not allow the destroyer to come into your house to strike you. Notice the sacrificial lamb itself is called the Passover. Lamb there is in italics. And I'll make note, Jesus Christ is also called the Passover in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7.
Well, this is something that I've kind of always wondered about. I assume that they also had Egyptian slaves and not just Hebrew slaves. They knew about this ahead of time. if any of the Egyptian people had heard, I mean, they've seen all these. This is probably going to happen. Like,
you think some of them might have killed a lamb?
Do you think some of them might have done that? Do you think would God have like still spared them?
You know, that's a good question. I can't answer definitively, but I've sort of thought probably so. I mean, if they're open-minded enough to say, "Hey, this God is real," He gives these instructions. I would think if God's saying, "Hey, they realize who I am and they're obeying," maybe He would respect them. Later on, we see that a mixed multitude would go out with Israel. So there are some Egyptians and perhaps slaves of other nations, perhaps people who have mixed ancestry going out. So yeah, it seems like a likely thing, although we have difficulty proving it absolutely, that there were some Egyptians who by this point are saying, "Hey, I'm with them. You know, forget Pharaoh, I'm going to do what this God says." So that wouldn't surprise me at all. And I see some heads nodding, you know. It's interesting. We'll be able to find out for certain later. Notice it mentions the destroyer. I've commented that I grew up hearing the term death angel, and I don't find it in at least the English translations I've read, but I think it probably comes from that. So the question is, again, is it the pre-incarnate Christ going around by himself? Is it an angel going around on his behalf, or maybe two of them? You know, and they're going around and say, "Hey, go in and get those guys and skip them." You know, I don't know. It's kind of silly to speculate. Kind of thing you do late at night, you know, when your laundry's in the dryer. Notice again, they're not permitted to leave their homes before morning, but you can make a connection to Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. Deuteronomy 16, 1 says, "God brought them out of Egypt by night." Okay, this is part of what helps us establish the timing. Okay, sundown beginning the 14th, they slay the lamb. They have to stay in their homes all night. Don't go out till morning. Later we read that when they did go out, it was by night. For those both to be true, it has to be as the sun goes down the next night, which we would say beginning the days of unleavened bread. Again, helping establish that Passover and days of unleavened bread are two separate things. And I mentioned that if you look at most calendars, if you buy a wall calendar, if it marks Passover, it'll usually put it on what is actually the first day of unleavened bread, because most practicing Jews have conflated the two, and I believe inappropriately, and the church teaches that. And, you know, we have to look at the scriptures and put them together, not overlap or subtract to get that. Oh, and Numbers 33, verse 3 makes that point, which I marked it here. Let me see why it, what it says. Numbers 33:3, "They departed from Ramses in the first month on the 15th day of the month, the day after Passover." Yeah, that's why, to show, okay, they left the day after Passover. Passover is the 14th. They left on the 15th. And I know I'm belaboring the point, but I'm belaboring the point because you'll find people in what we call the Church of God community that'll argue the exact opposite. And I want to show you why we teach what we do and why we keep it when we do. Okay, moving on then. Verse 24. "You shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever." Now, we've pretty much established that. "It'll come to pass when you come up to the when you come to the land which the Eternal will give you, just as He promised, you'll keep this service. And it'll be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this practice?' You'll say, 'It's the Passover sacrifice of the Eternal, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel when He struck the Egyptians and delivered our households.' So the people bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did." Again, let's give them credit. When the Israelites actually do just what God says, it's not that common, so we want to give them credit. And this idea of what's going on here? Why are we doing this? You know, I'm at the age now with my son where I start to get questions like this. Why do we do it this way? You know, and so it's a teaching opportunity. We talk about teachable moments. When your family is doing something unusual and the children say, "Why do we do this?" It's a great chance for teaching. In the Jewish way of keeping Passover, which they call the Seder, normally spelled S-E-D, I'm not sure if it's E-R or A-R, but they keep what, you know, we would call a Passover, but they have various customs that are not exactly what we do, including like having a hard-boiled egg and a set number of cups of wine. And I don't want to go through and compare that. But part of their ceremony includes usually having whoever the youngest male is who can talk ask questions and the oldest male answers. So they have a set of formal questions to address this. Charlie? It is Cedar. Okay. So we move on in verses 29 and 30. Came to pass at midnight, the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the captive that was in the dungeon, all the firstborn of the livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry. There was not a house where there was not one dead. It's difficult to imagine what this must have been like. I mean, we've heard of widespread death and destruction. It's worth noting that the language, the Hebrew, where it's translated not a house, probably would be better translated not a household, meaning a family. Because there might have been an individual house where there was no firstborn, depending on circumstances. Maybe it's unlikely the way extended families were then. And I've sometimes wondered, it raises the question of whether or not firstborn girls were among the slain. Many of the references seem to all be about males, but I don't think there's any place where it definitely says that only the firstborn males, not females. And I guess I'm curious about that because I've got an older sister. She was the firstborn in my family, but I was the firstborn male. So there's part of me wants to know which it is that's coming under the knife, even though we didn't have to worry about it. And I'm just pointing out that's something that's not entirely clear. And as we go through the Pentateuch, there are references to the firstborn where it's still not clear. And for us, it doesn't have to be. Moving on in verse 31, then he, referencing back to Pharaoh, in verse 30 it says, he rose in the night, he called for Moses and Aaron and said, rise up, go out from among my people. So this is not saying he called for them to come to him so he could talk to them. But remember, back in chapter 10, they all agreed they wouldn't see each other. So this seems to be saying he sent a messenger, probably a high-level messenger, and told them, you know, basically, leave. Go out, both you and the children of Israel, go serve the Eternal as you said, and take your flocks and herds as you said, be gone, and bless me also. Interesting, it seems he's finally acknowledging the power in this God that earlier he said, who is Yahweh? I don't know anything about him. I'm not letting the people go. Now he's agreed to every term that he previously rejected. He'd been trying to negotiate, you know, okay, just the men can go, or you can sacrifice here. Well, the men and women, but leave the animals. Now he's saying, all of you go. Just go do what you want. Okay, and they go. Verse 33, the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out in haste. They said, we're all going to die. The people took their dough before it was leavened, having kneading bowls bound up in their clothes. It's worth noting, of course, they would eat unleavened bread not just for lack of time to let the bread rise. You know, it's implied there, it's, yeah, they had to hurry, they didn't have time. But the instructions earlier had been very clear, you know, that, hey, it's about eating unleavened bread. So it works well with their situation. In verse 35, now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, gold, and clothing. And the Eternal had given people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they granted them what they requested, and they plundered the Egyptians. That word plundered is natsal, N-A-T-S-A-L. S-A-L, sorry. N-A-T-S-A-L. And it can be translated took. It can be translated recovered. You know, there's various ways. So plundered, I don't like the term because it implies they're stealing something. But it's saying, hey, give me stuff. You know, they've been in slavery for hundreds of years. Some people said this is kind of like getting back pay for all those years of slave labor. Possibly. Doesn't specifically say that. The instructions given earlier, and the way this is translated here implies that much, if not all, of this had been done before Passover. Because it says they had gone to the Egyptians and asked. So maybe from the time they set aside the lamb, you know, until Passover happens, they're going and asking these things. There's some room to wonder, though, if after sunrise on the 14th day, they might be visiting their neighbors and gathering stuff, and they're packing up their things and gathering so they can leave. So, at any event, it was probably a pretty busy day. Verse 37 says, the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth. Ramses, we believe, was a town in Goshen, and it was about probably 20 miles from there to Succoth. Succoth is the word that we see translated as tabernacles, as in Feast of Tabernacles, and it means a hut or a tent or, as we say, a temporary dwelling. It's probably referring to their first campsite. So they're gathering together. There's quite a number of them. So this first day is one of organizing, beginning the march, and they go a ways, and evidently nightfall comes, so it is as night that they're leaving. Yeah, in verse 37, the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. A mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. Again, the mixed multitude, probably slaves, maybe of other nations, but also Egyptians, who at this point say, hey, this God is the one that's got all the power. Let's go with them. 600,000 men. Many people estimate that, okay, if that's the men, there's probably also 600,000 women, and who knows how many children. Remember how they've been multiplying and growing, exceeding, they might have, 120,000 children. But we don't know. Most estimates say there's anywhere from 2 to 3 million people involved in this. And that's what we commonly teach in the church. I do want to make you aware that in common Bible scholarship, there is the discussion, and they call it the problem with numbers. Not necessarily with just the book of Numbers, but Hebrew numbers are not as clear as we wish. They weren't using the Arabic numerals that we do. And there's a Hebrew word, the Hebrew word for thousand, or the English word that's translated thousand from Hebrew, it comes from aleph, if I'm transliterating that properly. And the reason that's a question is that name, that word is also sometimes translated family or clan. Okay, so if you said instead of 600,000, you said 600 clans or 600 families, you could have 40 people in a family or a clan, and that's way less than 1,000. Okay, so some people make the argument that, no, this is more like 50 or 60,000 people. Now, I'm not making that argument. I'm not trying to convince you of that. I'm just making you aware that that discussion exists. And in some ways, it makes some of the things that happen seem easier, but it doesn't fit a lot of other things. For one thing, saying 600,000 besides children, you wouldn't say 600 families besides children. The word that seems to imply, no, it's 600,000 and children. And there are some other places where, you can make the argument, but in every place it seems to work, but then there's something that makes it not seem to work. Yeah, Charlie.
A good argument to say, because you'll have people saying there's no Egyptian records of an exodus out of Egypt of that many of millions of people. Is it safe to say the Egyptians overall were extremely embarrassed about the deliverance that God made, so they didn't put any records in their record books?
Yeah, it would be. And it's interesting. Actually, I think I've mentioned to you guys, I've been working my way through Josephus. And as an appendix to one of the things I've read, is the scholar who worked on this translation is citing a lot of ancient sources, and some of which, like Egyptian sources, that seem to be referring to it, but trying to cloud it and make it look different than it was. So there is evidence in some of ancient writings, but it's a different kind of story than we tell here. And you could see, like we say in any military history, the winner writes the history, and that seems to be the case here. And also, trying to think that patterns of evidence documentary that Mr. Dean showed, basically it makes the case that, okay, there's evidence of this great, of the Exodus, but a lot of scholars discount it because they say, well, it's not the right time frame. And one of the premises of the documentary is, like, if all these things fit, but you're just saying the time frame's wrong, maybe you need to move your time frame rather than saying it's not true. So I think there's something to that. But the best evidence, the best record we have, of course, is the one in Scripture. And we think that's reliable. So let me move on. I was hoping to get the end of the chapter before we take a break. But there's a lot of things we want to mention. Of course, 39 says they baked unleavened bread. We know that. Verse 40, the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out of the land of Egypt. I'll mention here that the Greek Septuagint. Remember, the Septuagint is the name for the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was done before the time of Christ. I'm trying to see where it includes. It includes "and their fathers." Because, and at the end of verse 41, it says, from the land of Egypt. The Septuagint says the land of Canaan and Egypt. So what I'm making the point is there are some versions that in, say the 430 years covers the time when the patriarchs were in Canaan as well as when the children of Israel were in Egypt. And you can add that up. It would make 430 years from the time Abram left Haran, which is the start of his story back in Genesis 12, until here. And Galatians 3, I wanted to turn there. Galatians 3, verses 16 and 17, I think seems to lean that way. Galatians 3, 16, yeah. To Abram, Abraham and his seed were the promises. He does not say to one seed. And I say this, the law which was 430 years later cannot annul the covenant was that was confirmed before by God in Christ. So the law 430 years later, meaning the time of the Exodus, seemingly being 430 years after God first made the promise to Abram. We can do a calculation on that, which I can show you if I do it correctly. Partly, we have some numbers that's given to us from, because from the time Abram's called, so Isaac is born, was how long? Okay, 25 years. That's right. He was called when he's 75. He's 100 when Isaac is born. Okay, from Jacob's... Oh, from then. From Isaac's birth to Jacob's... I'm trying to think if I've got this written down right. We've got 60 years. I mean, I'll give you the scriptural reference. This is Genesis 12, verses 4, and Genesis 21, verse 5. This is Genesis 25, verse 26. Will someone double-check that for me? Because I'm not sure if Jacob's birth is the one I wanted. But we do know from Jacob's birth to him going into Egypt. Okay, that is true. Okay, thanks. Gotcha. Okay, from the time Jacob was born till he goes to Egypt is 130 years. And that's in Genesis 47, verse 9. Because when Pharaoh asked Jacob, dude, how old are you? Well, I'm 130 years old. Okay, that's, we add that. Now, if you add all these together, we get what? Yeah, 215 years. Leaving, okay, if there's a 430-year total, there's 215 years, we would say that they were in Egypt. So this represents from the time Abram's called till Jacob and the others go into Egypt. From that point until they're coming out seems to be another 215 years. So what I'm saying is that seems to fit the translation that the Septuagint has and supports the idea that they're not in Egypt 400 years, but only a couple hundred. Okay, now, Genesis 15:13 is where Abram had this dream, and God says, know this, assuredly you'll be, you know, afflicted and you'll serve in a strange land for 400 years. So some scholars will look at that and say, no, they had to be in Egypt 400 years, not just 215. And then we go, well, come on, which is it? And I vacillate. One day I feel more one way and one day more the other. I'm sure whichever it is, God made work. So it isn't a question of did they ever do anything. How can we know? We're pretty sure. It's just there's two calculations. Yeah, Emily?
Which verse was that where it said that 400 years?
Genesis 15, verse 13. But a lot of people say, well, that includes the time when he and the other patriarchs were in Canaan. So, and the reason I'm giving you this is so you're aware of it, not that I'm going to ask you to do calculate this on a test. But if people bring up that, hey, were they there this long or there that long, you know, you can understand that there's a couple different ways to look at it. Yeah.
When it says the selfsame day, is it saying that something happened to Abraham on Passover unleavened bread?
That's exactly where I was going, actually. Are you looking at the King James Version? And verse 41, I believe it is. And the New King James, it says the very same day. The Old King James says the selfsame day. Okay. This seems to be, many people believe, referring back to the day that Abraham was circumcised. Because back when he was first circumcised, remember it says God gave him this instruction and he was circumcised on the selfsame day. And back then we just say, wow, he did it right away. But if we see the connection, and this, from what I understand, is a Hebrew word that's not used very often, it might be saying that God works on a very precise schedule. That maybe this was 430 years to the day. Of course, here we're talking about when Abraham was called, not when he was circumcised. Well, let's look at verse 42, of course. It is a night of solemn observance. So we're noting this particular night when they go out of Egypt. Night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. The night of the Lord, a solemn observance. The original King James said a night to be much observed. And we see that also in Numbers 33 and verse 3. They celebrated at the time as commemoration. They were being freed from slavery. You think of the speech by Martin Luther King Jr. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last. I mean, these guys could say that literally. So they're celebrating. We continue to celebrate it because following the Passover, we think of being celebrated or celebrating the freedom from sin and the penalty of it. And the scripture you could tie to that is Romans 6 and verse 16. Romans 6:16 is where Paul is writing. He says, to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves, of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. The point we want to make is that you can be considered a slave to sin, but we're freed, which is even greater than being freed from, you know, physical slavery. So we celebrate it, as it says, you know, we celebrate. I often call it the night to be, because you say, is it the night to be observed or the night to be remembered? I like to just say the night to be, but we make sure it's a special occasion. Solemn in some ways, but we celebrate, we have a happy time. We have a special meal, we gather together. I don't have to tell you guys, you've been doing it most of your lives, right? But we do it for good reason. And then there's some instructions about keeping the Passover. In verse 43, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat it. When every man's servant who's bought for money, when he's circumcised, then he can eat it. But not a sojourner or hired servant. In one house it'll be eaten. Don't carry the flesh outside the house. Don't break the bones. All the congregation of Israel will keep it. Not breaking a bone seems to foreshadow Christ's sacrifice. And remember in John 19, there's a reference that they broke the bones of the two criminals crucified with him, but Christ was already dead, so it fulfilled, you know, the prophecy that not a bone would be broken. He was, you know, like the Passover sacrifice. In verse 48, it says, when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover, let all his males be circumcised, and then he can come and do it. So there's one law for the native-born and the stranger. So it doesn't matter if you're born Israelite or not, all the males have to be circumcised to keep the Passover. How do we interpret that today? Okay, only the Passover could only be kept by those in families whose males were circumcised. We know the Apostle Paul said, look, you don't have to be circumcised for religious reasons. But I see several hands. Okay, the Holy Spirit, we've got a more outward symbolism, though.
So people who are baptized.
Yeah, is that where you're going, Andrew? And the scripture for that is Colossians 2, verses 11 and 12. Colossians 2, 11 and 12 says, the circumcision of Christ, baptism. I'm taking that out, you know, because basically it's part of a sentence, comma, but it basically says that baptism is the circumcision of Christ. Which is good. It fits with Galatians 3:28. There's male nor female. So this isn't something just for the men in the family. It's for anyone. When you're baptized, you can keep the Passover. Some people have not liked that. It's like, hey, I come to church. I believe. Why can't I keep the Passover? Well, we tie it to what it says here at the end of Genesis or Exodus 12. Only those who are circumcised could keep the Passover. For us, it's not physical circumcision. It's the circumcision of Christ, which is baptism. And so we have that restriction. When you're baptized, that's the requirement for keeping Passover.